Greetings, folks. I hope that you are all staying well and staying safe and keeping your spirits up. This is a studio recording of my March 15th sermon that's called Sister Act. I'm going to begin with a reading and then play a chime between the reading and sermon and then carry on. Again, take care. I hope that all is well and I hope that you enjoy this. If you're only inspired by Horatio Alger-type stories about people making it all by themselves, pulling themselves up by their own bootstraps through honest, hard work, I might disappoint you today. Horatio Alger was also a Unitarian minister, but he didn't write stories about people like Abraham, who got a lot of help in what he did and didn't always do it honestly. He was living in the land of Haran and going by the name of Abram when God called out to him. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves. Blessings. Whatever he'd been doing for a living before this call came in, he seems to have been doing it quite well at it, because we're told that he started his journey loaded with possessions that he'd acquired and an entourage that included a number of servants and relatives and his lovely wife, Sarai. How lovely was she? The Bible drops plenty of hints that drop-dead gorgeous would be an understatement for Sarai, which means my princess. Famine strikes the land and the travelers head to Egypt. But as they get close, Abraham says to her, I know that you are a woman beautiful to behold, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is my wife, this is his wife, and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say, you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared on your account. So when Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And they praised her to Pharaoh and took her to his house. And for her sake, he gave Abram sheep, oxen, men servants, maid servants, cattle, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this that you've done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, take her and be gone. And Pharaoh sent him on the way with his wife and all that he had. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had and his relatives, into the southern plains. Now Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver, and gold. I don't think you could say exactly that Abram was a blessing for Pharaoh, but this whole deal was certainly a blessing for Abram. We guess the silver and gold were in the form of ornaments, probably gifts to Sarah. So far, the Bible has not mentioned the use of money in the form of coins as such, but it does tell us that so far Abram has done very well by God and by his wife. Sheep, cattle, camels, servants, silver, and gold. I bet he also has a song in his heart after scoring so much stuff in Egypt. That was my chime, a very poor substitute for Deborah's playing. Abram did so well by putting his wife up to this sister act that I don't think we'll be surprised to see him trying to pull it off a second time. Now they're both going by new names. No surprise for what you might call a pair of con artists. He's Abraham now, father of a multitude, and she's Sarah, the princess, not just my princess. Some years have passed. In fact, quite a few years have passed. He's 100 years old and she's 90. But guess what? She's still got looks to die for. Here's how they do it this time around. Abraham was passing through the land of Gerar. And Abraham said of Sarah, his wife, she's my sister. And the king of Gerar sent and took Sarah. But God came to him in a dream and said, behold, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you've taken, for she is another man's wife. Now the king had not approached her, so he said, Lord, will you kill an innocent man? Did he not himself say to me, she's my sister? And she herself said, he's my brother? In the integrity of my heart, in the innocence of my hands, I have done this. Then God said to him in the dream, "Yes, I know it. Was I who kept you from sinning against me and did not let you touch her. Restore the man's wife to him, for he is a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. But if you do not, know that you shall surely die, you and all that are yours." I know that this is the Bible, a book that people turn to for moral guidance, but right here it looks more like a guide for how to pull a three-way grift, a swindle. I'll say you're my sister, you say that's right, then God will handle the rest. No surprise that God should pop up in a Bible story, I guess, even if he's talking like a gangster boss with that "you are a dead man" line of his. Let's see how things turn out. So the king called Abram and said to him, "What have you done to us? And how have I sinned against you that you've brought this on me and my kingdom? You've done to me things that ought not to be done. What were you thinking?" Abraham said, "I did it because I thought there's no fear of God at all in this place, and they will kill me because of my wife. Besides, she is indeed my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. And when God caused me to wander from my father's house, I said to her, 'This is the kindness you must do to me. At every place to which we come, say of me, he is my brother.'" You got to hand it to Abraham here for changing his story fast. We never heard about Sarah being his half-sister before. He didn't mention it to Pharaoh the last time, or about this agreement to pass as his sister wherever they travel, or about the religious angle. "We were afraid you weren't honest, God-fearing folks around here like we are. It's all about God, you see, so we had to do it, right?" A cynic could easily say, "Look at Abraham, Sarah, and God working that same grift again. What's the payoff going to be this time around?" The Bible tells us the king took sheep and oxen and male and female slaves and gave them to Abraham and restored Sarah, his wife, to him. And Abimelech said, "Behold, my land is before you. Dwell where it pleases you." To Sarah he said, "Behold, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver. It is your vindication in the eyes of all who are with you. And before everyone, you are righted." Building on the success of Sister Act 1, Sister Act 2 has scored Abraham more blessings, for himself anyway, sheep, cattle, slaves, silver, plus some real estate. This time the silver is in pieces, 1,000 of them. This passage about the silver is a strange one. The original Hebrew could mean either pieces of jewelry or just chunks of the metal, but it cannot mean coins. It's called a vindication in English, but the original calls it a covering of the eyes, as if it's in exchange for borrowing Sarah's beauty for a while, exchanging the silver's beauty for hers. Later, we'll see Abraham trade some sheep and cows with the king to secure water rights at a well he has dug in the good king's land. But he's not spending any money yet. That time will come, but not for many years. First, Sarah will give birth to their son Isaac when she is 90 years old. Way to go, sister! Next will come the most famous of all the Abraham stories, when God decides to test his faith by telling him to sacrifice the boy on a mountaintop. For a moment, it looks like God is telling Abraham that the debt he owes for his success has come due. He has to pay, not with money or cattle, but with his son's life, for all of the blessings he has enjoyed so far. But no, at the very last moment, just as he raises the knife to perform the sacrificial act, God tells him to stop. It's enough that he was willing to do the deed. Out of nowhere, a ram appears, and Abraham sacrifices that instead and receives as his reward all the lands around him. Another score! The Bible tells us that Sarah died in Hebron some years later at the age of 127. Not so surprising, I guess, for someone who gave birth at the age of 90, still so beautiful that she can turn the heads of kings. But now she's gone, and Abraham goes to Hebron to weep and mourn for her and to find her a suitable tomb here in the land of the people, whom the Bible calls the sons of Heth, or Hittites. He says to them, "I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." It seems at first that Abraham is asking for a gift from the Hittites, or at least that's what they hear. So the Hittites answered Abraham, "Hear us, my lord. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will hinder you." Abraham rose and bowed to the Hittites, and he said to them, "If you are willing that I should bury my dead, please ask Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as a possession for a burying place." So it seems now that while the Hittites have agreed to make a gift of any tomb that Abraham chooses, now he's offering to pay for one that he already has in mind. He's done his research and knows that it belongs to Ephron, who's there that day. Now Ephron, the Hittite, answered Abraham in the hearing of all who were there at the gate of his city, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it, in the presence of the sons of my people. I give it to you. Bury your dead." Then Abraham bowed down before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron, "I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there." This story has generated a lot of discussion. It's not easy after hearing it to say exactly what has happened. Abraham asks for a gift. The Hittites say, "Sure thing," but then he offers to pay anyway. He seems at first to want just any tomb that's available. Strangers begging can't be choosers. But then we find that he actually has a specific tomb in mind, the Cave of Machpelah. The Bible doesn't tell us what's special about this place, but later rabbis tell a legend about it and about how Abraham had visited the cave earlier and found it to be the resting place of, guess who? Adam and Eve themselves, the very first human couple. And I do mean it's their resting place. Abraham finds them both laid out, looking fresh but asleep, with a candle burning at their heads and a sweet smell filling the cave. When he prepares a place for Sarah beside them, they pop right up and try to leave, saying, "They're not fit for such company. You and Sarah have been so good, whereas we really blew it by eating that forbidden fruit back in the garden." They either don't know about the younger couple's sister act or else find no fault with it. Abraham persuades Adam to return, but they both together have to drag Eve back into the cave and cajole her to lie down again. But the Bible says nothing about all this, and the cave's Hittite owner seems to think there's nothing special about his cave except that now somebody wants it to put some body inside. He offers to give it to Abraham along with the field that it lies in. Abraham bows respectfully but asks Ephron to accept payment. Ephron protests, saying, "My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Abraham agreed and weighed out for Ephron 400 shekels of silver according to the weights current among the merchants. Some scholars suggest that this whole performance reflects Hittite bargaining practices, pretending to offer something as a gift while hoping this gesture will jack up the price. Ephron really wants top shekel for his field. I assume that these commentators know more than I do about ancient Near Eastern business practices, but given what we've read so far in the Bible, how can we say the price of 400 shekels is too high? We have heard gold and silver mentioned before as ornaments and as material that can be counted in pieces, but this is the first purely monetary transaction that has ever been mentioned in a Bible story. It's something we haven't heard of before. 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. That's money, folks. Money, as we know it today. Careful readers will notice something remarkable about the characters in this story that includes Abraham, Ephron, and a cast of Hittite extras. Somewhere off stage is the extraordinary body of Sarah, and maybe the bodies of Adam and Eve, too. But is there someone else you might expect to encounter in this story who never shows up? Where's the big guy? Where's the boss? Did you notice that God is never even mentioned? Since the very beginning of the book, when God created the heavens and the earth and everything on it, this is the first Bible story without God in it. The first story without God is the first story with money. Wow. And it's also the first story we've heard where Abraham does an honest deal No sister act, no interventions by the boss on his behalf. He deals straight with other people this time. He says, hey, I've got this. And part of what this means is he's got the money ready to make this happen. But what's the money for? Is it really about a real estate transaction? Or is it more about creating a sacred space? Creating a sacred space. Let's look ahead to what's almost the end of the book of Genesis. Many, many years have passed, and now Abraham's grandson, Jacob, is about to die. So he calls his large family together and tells them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my ancestors in the cave in the field at Machpelah. There, Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried. There, Isaac and his wife Rebekah were buried. And there, I buried my wife Leah. This is also where we can supposedly still find Adam and Eve, the first human beings, in a special place apart, resting, but not really gone. I think this means that the cave at Machpelah is meant to be a place where human community can find rest and peace. You've heard of a man cave? That's a popular notion these days. This is more of a values cave. You could hardly call that a tomb any more than you could say it about the space that we are making here together at YEAST. Like the cave in the field at Machpelah, it's a space that connects us to our origins, to generations past, present, and future, and to the stories that we share. It's a storytelling house, a singing house, a place to share breath and bread and the great breadth of our human experience. And it's a uniquely human kind of space that we can shape together by sharing our time, talent, and treasure. I like to think that the God of the Bible steps aside for the moment so people can work this balance out together. No need to say, do this for me, when it's so clear that we do it for each other. It's not just Sister Act Part 3. It's an act for every sister, brother, and other who might not fit those labels. That's a real blessing for a change. One that does so much more than just bringing profit to one person, whether he's a prophet or not. The creation of a sacred space, a sacred hour, or even a sacred moment doesn't depend on the invocation or even the existence of any God at all. Portland author Ursula K. Le Guin asks, what is sacredness? What is true is sacred. What has been suffered? What is beautiful? The sacredness is there, in the truth, the pain, the beauty, so that the telling of it is sacred. And so our annual stewardship campaign is a chapter of the story we are telling about ourselves. What we value, whom we value, and how we express that value to each other, and to make our name a blessing. Nothing more and nothing less. And now a member of our stewardship team will speak and tell us some of the plan for how we'll be telling that story this year. Welcome.
Hi, everybody. It's Matt Lynch with the YEAST Canvas Committee. And this year, like so many things, the Canvas is going to be done a little bit differently. We're hoping that everything will be done digitally. So you'll have already received an email, hopefully, about the details of pledging. If you haven't, you might check your junk email or your spam email, or just reach out to any of the Canvas Committee members. That would be myself, Matt Lynch, or Hank Hathaway, or Bruce McPherson, and you can just ask any questions you've got. If you know what you'd like to pledge for the coming up year, 2020 to 2021, then you can just send an email to pledge@yeastuu.org and tell us how much you'd like to pledge, either per month or for the entire year. And the sooner that we can get all that done, it would be so much more convenient for us. And if there are folks we haven't heard from yet in a few weeks, then we will be sending out the envelopes with the forms and all of that, if that's the way that works for you. But ideally, we could all get these pledges in sooner rather than later. I know everyone on the Canvas Committee would thank you so much. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to, like I said, myself, Hank Hathaway, or Bruce McPherson, and we are all in the YEAST directory. You can get in touch by email or by phone or whatever works for you. Thanks so much, and happy pledging!